This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hotel and Lodging Association Director Ray Sarisa says the average room rate in Bloomington Normal is now below $90 a night. Even slight declines make a difference.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. It doesn't seem that much by 2%, but when you do the math.
Ryan Denham talks with Sarisa about the dismal hotel occupancy rate. Can the Illinois General Assembly pass a budget? Former Governor Jim Edgar thinks so. Find out what Bloomington State Senator Jason Barrickman thinks. Charlie Schlenker has the interview. And there's no shortage of material for the Capitol Steps musical political satire troupe. Find out how the Trump administration and social media can affect the group's material. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Friday, May 11th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Changes at State Farm are hanging over the local economy in many ways, from real estate to jobs to philanthropy. It may also be one of the big pressures on the struggling Bloomington Normal hotel industry. They're facing low occupancy and falling room rates. Ray Sarisa runs the DoubleTree by Hilton in Bloomington. He's also president of the local hotel and lodging association. He tells GLT's Ryan Denham it's a dismal situation.
Year-to-date, 2018, we're off to a very slow start. Usually our season starts in about March and goes all the way till Thanksgiving. It didn't really start in March this year. We're kind of seeing it right now, actually in April, mid-April, at my property. Year-to-date through March, I don't have April's numbers yet. Our Bloomington Normal hotels are only at a 44% occupancy rate, which is, I think last year we finished about 52-53%.
And when you say occupancy rate, just for our listeners to understand what that concept means.
Well, you got a 100-room hotel, only 44 of those rooms are booked.
If we're at 44% occupancy rate as of the end of March, how does that compare to what other metro areas and statewide averages? Is that low, do you think, compared to other areas?
We are low compared to other areas. We are a little bit comparable to Peoria, last I talked to some of the folks over there.
So why do you think that the occupancy rate is so low in Bloomington Normal?
A number of reasons. Really, the number one is probably all the activity at State Farm. You know, State Farm is doing a lot, but they're doing a lot in Phoenix and in Dallas and in Atlanta. So a lot of their travel is going that way, and we're not seeing as much transient business, and transient's the independent business traveler coming to Bloomington Normal.
What other factors go into that?
You know, people are watching their dollar. I talk to my sales department all the time, and, you know, for a meeting room for a full day, for a small meeting room, we might charge $250. You know, people are coming in and saying, well, that's way over my budget. I'm at 50 bucks, you know, and that's kind of what we're dealing with day to day with clients.
When a market is at 44% occupancy, like it is right now, so what does that actually mean then for a hotel's bottom line? How does that impact you? Are you making different types of staffing decisions, trying to save money elsewhere? How does that actually play out then?
Absolutely. That's the general manager's role to, you know, we have to shave dollars off the bottom line. And that our number one expense is payroll. It is labor. So unfortunately, those folks that we count on to work our front desk, clean our rooms, serve our banquets, we have to closely watch their hours because it can easily, I don't want to say get out of control, but if you're not watching those hours, then your bottom line gets much worse. Anything spending, too. We're looking at all of our regular purchases on a monthly basis to see if we can get better pricing from different vendors, shopping around. You know, we're always going to need new towels, new sheets, new soaps, things like that. Can we get a better price from somewhere else?
Are there certain types of hotels in our market that are doing better than others, either upscale hotels or even like very economy-priced hotels? I mean, is there variance then within sort of the range?
Sure. I can't speak on behalf of each individual hotel because we don't necessarily share our occupancy rates, occupancy percentage and rates with each other. The report and the 44% I got is our hotels collectively report to a company called Smith Travel Research, and they send out the numbers to those who participate in it. I can tell you my hotel is about 20% ahead of the market. So if that tells you, you know, DoubleTree is a full-service hotel, but we also have a huge conference center. So, you know, with conferences and weddings and things like that, and that conference center is there to fill the hotel rooms. Yeah, I'm sure there is a difference in the different types of different classes of hotels, some doing better. Again, my hotel is still down. So, like I said before, I have to figure out ways to cut expenses or watch my expenses so I can keep the bottom, improve the bottom line.
So the average daily rate for a room is also down. It looks like it's about $87 a night at this point. That's down about 2%. So what is the significance of that, seeing the average daily rate of a room decline?
Thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. It doesn't seem that much by 2%. But when you do the math, even at my hotel, if I'm down a couple bucks, you know, and I'm you know, we have thousands of rooms per month, it's thousands of dollars just for my property. And what happens is when we see a lull in occupancy, you know, it's supply and demand. You know, you're going to cut your rates down, and maybe you're going to grab that budget-conscious client that's looking for the best deal. And then it's a trickle-down effect.
So, Ray, you've mentioned these challenges that the local hotel business faces with occupancy rates and even seeing the average daily rate of a room decline. Like, what can be done about it? Is there anything from a local policymaking perspective or in promoting tourism? Is there anything that would alleviate any of this pressure that you guys are feeling?
Really, what we need is some economic development. And we're heading in that direction. You know, our EDC here in town has, along with the town of Normal and the city of Bloomington, we've attracted some new businesses to the area. We're very excited about that in the hotel industry. Brandt being one of them. There was one announced last night, and I didn't write down the name of the company, that was supposed to create 100 new jobs. Also Rivian, you know, we're keeping our fingers crossed that Rivian is a huge success and generates hotel rooms for our market. And, you know, even if they're not staying at my hotel, coming into the market, that's going to help everybody. And not just hotels, it's going to help restaurants, it's going to help gas stations, it's going to help retail, everything in the economy. So we need more and more. We need some big companies to come to Bloomington Normal. We've got the talent. We have great hotels. We have you know, three interstates that meet here. So we're 2 hours from Chicago, 2.5, 3 hours to St. Louis, 3 hours in Indianapolis. You know, it's a great community, and we just need to get the word out to companies looking to grow or expand or move. Let them know about Bloomington, and we're doing that. I don't know if some marketing or you know exactly what the answer is, but that's what we need, some more economic development.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Ray Cerisa, general manager at the DoubleTree by Hilton in Bloomington and also president of the Bloomington Normal Hotel and Lodging Association. Let's pivot and talk about Airbnb and some of these other home sharing platforms where you can rent out your place or a room in your place to someone else privately. What impact have these home sharing platforms had on the local hotel marketplace?
Well, last I looked, there were just over 60 Airbnb listings, and it fluctuates. They drop in, they drop off, and, you know, they're not necessarily, I don't think, listed every single day, 365 days a year, but, you know, 60 Airbnb listings, that's 60 hotel rooms. They're taking away 60 hotel rooms from us. Now, Airbnb is not going away, just like Uber and Lyft aren't going away, but, and we recognize that, and, all we ask is that they play by the same rules that the hotels have to. You know, we pay taxes. We pay a 12% occupancy tax per room. Airbnb's taxing, there's a part on there that they can collect tax, but are these owners actually turning around and paying that tax? And part of our occupancy tax here in Bloomington goes to the CVB, the Convention and Visitors Bureau. And the idea of, and that's an intergovernmental agreement between the Town of Normal and the City of Bloomington to take a portion of that lodging tax and give it to the CVB so they can reinvest it in their marketing and their efforts to bring new business or tournaments and conferences and bring them to Bloomington Normal and Airbnb's not doing that. Also, we have fire inspections by the Town of Normal and City of Bloomington. We have to have exit signs over, like any commercial facility, exit signs over every exit. We have to have working fire extinguishers. We have a fire panel. Are these Airbnbs being inspected? What if there's a fire and there was no working sprinkler system or smoke detectors or fire system and someone gets killed? We do all that. We just want them to also play by the same rules. A lot of the Airbnb folks, too, aren't just... like a lot of them aren't you and me renting out your couch or renting out the basement. Some of these are businesses that are renting out vacant apartments. So they're companies. Champaign-Urbana is a good example. They have over 300 Airbnb listings. Most of those are vacant apartments, or one was even, there's a story out there where there was a fraternity house that I think they lost their chapter or something like that. Well, they had an empty fraternity house. Well, they rented it. They turned it over to a couple that was going to manage it, an Airbnb, the fraternity house. And it was equivalent to, I have to look at the article, but it was like 30 hotel rooms in just this fraternity house. And Champaign-Urbana has, they have a mom's weekend and a dad's day weekend, and they have homecoming where all the hotels were always jam-packed, and they count on those weekends to make their money. They weren't filling the hotels because of the amount of Airbnb listings in Champaign-Urbana. So my point is, it's already out of control in Champaign-Urbana. Bloomington Normal, it's, we're only at 60 listings. We need to act upon it now in order to, before it gets out of control, and it's like, what do we do now? There's way too many of them. So, Champaign-Urbana, 300 plus listings, that's a 300 room hotel.
So, and you've recently asked Bloomington and Normal officials to add the Airbnb issue to their agendas and to act quickly, as you put it. So what specifically are you hoping that they do?
Just a little bit of regulation, the same rules that we have to play by. Pay taxes, get that money to the CVB to attract businesses or conferences and sporting events and things to the area. It needs to be addressed before it gets out of control. Because let's say it does get out of control and, it's equivalent to a 300-room hotel, you're going to start seeing some of these smaller hotels or these hotels that aren't maybe just scraping by, they're going to end up closing. We need to support our current businesses that have been here, that have been paying taxes all these years, providing jobs and contributing to the local economy. We just ask that these Airbnb listings do the same.
Why are people turning to Airbnb even in a market like this, where, as we discussed earlier, there's a lot of empty hotel rooms and they're getting cheaper. Mm-hmm. So why do people still turn to these private home sharing options?
That's a good question. Especially, in our market, I could see if you're going to a touristy area on a lake somewhere and wanting to rent out a cabin or something like that, this would be a great vehicle for to rent something like that, but here for an apartment, I don't know. I don't know. I've never rented an Airbnb.
That's Ray Cerisa, general manager at the DoubleTree by Hilton in Bloomington, and also president of the Bloomington Normal Hotel and Lodging Association. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can see an interactive graphic showing Bloomington Normal Hotel occupancy rates compared with other cities at our website, wglt.org. It's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Vitesse Cycles Shop, where your patronage and friendship is valued. Vitesse Cycles' goal is to promote health and well-being through cycling. Learn more about the Electra Townie and other bike brands, all with Vitesse's professional advice, service, and accessories at VitesseCycle.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Just under 3 weeks remain in the spring session of the General Assembly. Former Governor Jim Edgar said this week he thinks there is a strong possibility a budget can happen. But still, there is no budget. There's still no agreement on the shape of a budget. There is still no agreement on even how much money the state is expected to take in this year. Charlie Schlenker talks with State Senator Jason Barrickman of Bloomington about the spending plan and the holdup on the revenue estimate.
Well, I don't know. I think there's some I mean, there's clearly a disagreement on the revenue estimate. It's hard to explain. I don't think that we should be entirely focused on the politics at play at the moment, and more in the bigger picture of, do we come together and adopt a full year balanced budget? I think it's very possible to do it this year. I think the stage is set. The political dynamic is such that there's pressure on both sides to come together on an agreement. I don't think the public wants to look. They want us to do our job, right? They want us to come together. We're a divided government. Republican in the executive branch, Democrats control the legislative branch. We all know that it's going to be a big, nasty, expensive election year, but people would rather we get our job done first before those fireworks begin. So I'm of the opinion I've shared with anyone who will listen at this point. My opinion is that our job's to sit down and hash it out. And I know the legislative leaders and the governor have met. That created some of the sparks of the week about the revenue number. The reality is I think that rank-and-file legislators, like they have done in the past, are likely going to continually push on both sides, the leaders of both sides, and hopefully that helps propel us and get us towards a deal. I think it's possible.
It is not uncommon for there to be no sign of even the shape of a budget this late in the spring term. Even before the last 2 years, it wasn't all that uncommon. But how close are you to having a revenue estimate, having a general estimate of where the cuts are going to have to come, and having the potential for a full year agreement? You know, there's been a lot of buzz as well about a partial year agreement.
Let's start with the revenue estimate. There's two numbers which are historically utilized for revenue estimates. There's a number put out by the governor's office, his budget office, and there's a number published by what's called COGFA, which is an independent arm of the legislature. Those two numbers, I don't have them in front of me, but those two numbers, the published numbers for both of those, are very close in the context of a $30+ billion revenue estimate and budget. So that's where I say, whether we get obsessed about whether you're using COGFA or you're using the governor's the governor's budget number, the bottom line is they're very close. What's most important is that we come to a spending number that is, below these revenue estimates. And that is where the challenge lies. I don't think the challenge lies in, do you use COGFA to use the governor's budget, revenue budget number? The challenge lies in, how do you cut spending in a manner that what is appropriated this year doesn't exceed the revenues? And that's where some big decisions are going to have to be made.
And there's less progress on that side, partly because the Democrats have not yet come up with their own version, and the governor has not come up with what he promised in his budget address, which is a plan to do the pension cost shift and to do some health benefit reductions to save the state money. Those aren't on the table in even a draft form. So those are considered to be dead letter by Democrats. So does he have to do that? Or what does he have to do on his part to further the dialogue?
Well, I think that the governor put forward a budget. It certainly asked the legislature to make some tough decisions, whether it be in the cost shift, the health care benefits. The Democrats have, since the introduction of that budget, said those are non-starters. They're not willing to advance those ideas. Interestingly so, when you consider that the health care proposal was something bantered about in the grand bargain, and the cost shift proposal first was proposed by Speaker Madigan. So, those things, I think...
It wasn't quite the cost shift and the pension proposal that the governor proposed, however. It was over a much longer period of time, and you've got school districts saying, the shorter period of time just isn't doable.
Right. Totally agree, Charlie. But however, when the Democrats came out after the governor's budget, where he introduced these ideas, they did not say, you know, the Democrats did not say, well, we're willing to do a cost shift, but over a longer period of time. Instead, they said, we're not willing to even have this conversation.
Why are Republicans willing to have the conversation, given the impact on property taxes?
Well, I've long have said that, you know, a discussion of the policy matters merits of a cost shift is a discussion worth having. I think that, you know, several years ago when this, you know, topic first arose, we heard from school districts. Of course, they're concerned about the manner in which a cost shift might be implemented and the immediate effect it could have on their budgets and property taxes. I'm very sensitive to that. What we heard from school districts is that if you tie in a phased cost shift over time and allow the school districts to implement it or embrace it in conjunction with their union contract negotiations, which don't occur every year, they often occur over a period, you know, a couple of years, that they could and would be willing to absorb a cost shift like that. The university systems had similar discussions about the manner in which they would embrace a cost shift. So I don't, you know, when you've got the stakeholders out there talking about realistic solutions, I don't think anyone, Republicans or Democrats, should flippantly dismiss the idea as a non-starter. I think we've got to be creative in how we come to a balanced budget agreement in our state. The people have asked us to look more creatively. They've asked us to make some tough decisions. And so I think it's just it's short-sighted to flippantly remove some of these ideas immediately from the policy discussion.
But doing so, having a policy discussion over 3 months since the budget speech, or now 3 weeks, how likely is that to produce good decisions?
Well, look, I wish we would have spent time since the budget address on some of these things. But when the speaker comes out and says we're not going to, engage on the ideas that the governor's put forward, when you consider that he's the guy that controls whether legislation advances ultimately through the General Assembly, when he puts a brick on it, those conversations just don't happen. Now, I will tell you, I have had many fruitful conversations with education leaders, school superintendents, school board members, property taxpayers throughout Central Illinois, both before the governor introduced the cost shift proposal and since. And I think there's a heightened awareness of the risks, right? The ultimate risk of property tax increase. But no one is saying don't have the conversation. People are saying, you know, figure out some solutions.
So is it likely that this will become a vetted policy proposal in a year or two?
One never knows. I mean, I can't, as you know, I can't predict the future. I think the only question about our future is that which lies in the immediate future. Can we come together on a budget agreement that's balanced in full year? Whether a cost shift is or isn't a part of that, I think does not necessitate coming together on a balanced budget. What's necessitated is that the two sides communicate and demonstrate a willingness to move and compromise with one another. And I do think that's possible this year.
If not those two things, the pension shift and health care cuts, where will the cuts come, do you think, to balance a spending plan?
Once you get beyond Medicaid and pensions, when you factor in that everyone wants to spend and, in fact, you know, has been encouraged to spend more money on schools, K through 12, there's not a lot left after that to cut from. You know, you're left with things like higher ed, public safety, health and human services, things and groups who have historically taken it on the chin in the budgeting process. There's also, the flip side of this. You know, we've talked for several years now about doing things like selling the Thompson Center as a mechanism to generate some money, not enough money to balance the budget entirely, but some money that, you know, on a one-time basis is helpful. Again, our job is, I think, be open-minded, try to come together on some agreements. The governor, and I think appropriately, the governor has said he's not going to sign a tax increase. I don't think the legislature is going to advance a tax increase this year.
The Center for Budget and Tax Accountability, Ralph Martiri's think tank, has indicated that overall state spending has gone up about 3% over the last significant period of years. I think it's 5 years. And yet services have been cut more than 20%. So all of that is basically debt service on pension and the pension ramp requiring increased payments because it was underfunded for so many decades. The legislature and governors chose to borrow against the pension to finance services at that time.
I've been raising these issues for years now. If lawmakers want to continue to bury their heads in the sand, then they will continually ignore the growing liabilities in our Medicaid and pension systems. Those two line items alone cost well over $20 billion a year. And when you consider, again, our annual budget is in the $30 billion range. The fact that $20 billion comes out of those two programs is not, you know, missed by me. If we do nothing, those two line items are going to continue to grow. And we do. We've talked about pensions a lot. No one's talking about the Medicaid liabilities that are growing. That's a result of the Federal Affordable Care Act and the notion that that federal program really asks states to buy in, knowing that the federal government would pony up most of the money on the front end. But now those dollars are beginning to drop off, yet the states are still stuck with the full liability. So,
this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with State Senator Jason Berrickman. Is there a way forward on the Medicaid issue? Is it just a matter of cutting Medicaid, which of course places it back on hospitals and unreimbursed care?
So, you know, what's, again, if you have to look at the historical trends here, the trends within the Medicaid system that I think are concerning to me and should be concerning to Illinoisans are the growth in who qualifies and the growth in what they qualify for. So if you raise the income thresholds for who qualifies for Medicaid, more people are on the Medicaid rolls. 5 years ago, I used to talk about the fact that roughly 3 million of our 13 million people were on Medicaid. Well, we're losing population. I don't think we're losing people who were on the Medicaid system.
Poor people.
Yeah, what we're losing is high net worth and high earning people. So our 13 million population is coming down. And again, 5 years ago, we were talking about the Affordable Care Act coming into play. Now that that is fully implemented, more people are on the Medicaid system. I don't know what the current count is, but it's gone up because more people are eligible. Now, it doesn't mean that there's more poor people out there. It means that there's more people who qualify for Medicaid. The other area where there's been growth is
Those people have always needed care. Do you shift the costs to insurance companies and people who can pay, or do you continue to have a government role in that? Where do you cut that?
Well, look, it's bringing things down to a new norm. The new norm today says people of, and we could pull out the rates and tell you what a family of four can make to qualify, but that number has continually gone up. And so that's why I've said, I think you've got to bring that back down so that the new norm recognizes, I think this is where people who have an ability to provide for this care and services out of their pocket or out of their private insurance, that needs to be reinforced as well, Charlie.
But they're also paying for the low-income people. If you reduce who qualifies, the people who can pay and the people who have insurance will foot the bill for those who cannot pay. If government gets out of this or reduces its stake in that equation, because the overall use of health care will not go down.
Right. But again, Charlie, I'm recognizing that there's a difference between someone who makes $30,000 a year and $80,000 a year. And accepting that people who are on the higher earning end of qualifying for Medicaid, if there is not a governmental health care service available to them, are not necessarily going to land in an emergency room without insurance. They're maybe going to get a different job or get a different insurance plan or get some pay out of their pocket, do something that results in less governmental costs without putting them, you know, again, into an emergency room or some other high cost care. The other side, so we talk about who qualifies, the other side is what they qualify for, right? This, again, is where a lot of the liability growth in Medicaid has been seen. The services which are available to qualifying Medicaid recipients has grown. There's an effort this year to push dental care costs to Medicaid. There's two sides to every story. While there is certainly an argument that some preventative and maintenance dental care can help curb larger expenses down the road, there has to be a balance to that so that you're not, again, operating at, you know, one end or the other of the spectrum, which is kind of this all or nothing. And too much all or nothing, let's give all the benefits that we can give, has resulted in, again, a growth in the liability.
On the pension side, there has been a periodic proposal to basically refinance and extend the pension ramp and make the payments more manageable that way. What is your sense of that particular idea?
Well, thus far, changes proposed to the ramp seem to double down on mistakes of the past, right? Well, money's tight today, so let's lower our payments today and push off the hurt and pain and expense to tomorrow, somewhere down the road. I don't think that there is going to be an appetite in the legislature to do that, because the public is electing people who says, you know, who say, don't kick the can down the road again. I want, you know, choices to be made today. I want tough choices to be made today so that these problems go away and aren't problems that the next generation has to deal with. I don't think that there's any solution to the pension matter that is going to resolve that issue in a short period of time. If we keep doing what we're doing, there's a payment schedule that's going to continually hurt.
It's going to be brutal.
It's going to be brutal, and it's going to be brutal for a long time.
Yeah.
So you can't solve that today with some even more brutal solution that takes all the pain in a shorter amount of time. I think that what we have to do is we have to look at this realistically. There is a constitutional obligation to honor these commitments that have been made by the state to, you know, a growing pool of retirees and a pool of employees who were hired before a certain, you know, date, I think back in 2011. One of the best things that can be done is that which we've done since I've been in the legislature, which is you suck it up and you make the payment. You don't borrow from the system. You know, no different than a family who is saving for retirement. You can't skip out on those annual obligations, because if you do, you're going to see that on a negative side down the road. I don't see that there's going to be any significant changes to the pension system this year, but I think next year it's back at the front of the you know, on the front burner as an issue that the legislature is going to have to come to grips with.
State Senator Jason Barrickman is a Republican from Bloomington. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker for Sound Ideas. had during Sound Ideas. It's a conversation with a founding member of the Capitol Steps. The musical satire group plays the BCPA on Sunday. John Norton has the interview. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. For months, Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner's administration has repeatedly said it did everything to properly notify frontline workers about the threat of Legionnaires' disease at a state veterans home. Here he is talking to a Decatur newspaper in February.
We took strong, immediate action, communicated with employees, and that was put out, Erica Jeffries put out that clear statement about how they communicated. There's a lot of politics getting played right now.
But documents obtained by Illinois Public Radio undercut that narrative from Rauner and his Veterans Affairs Director, Erica Jeffries. They show Rauner's own administration raised concerns about how it notified Quincy healthcare workers about a deadly Legionnaires outbreak in 2015. Reporters Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold talk with IPR's Greta Johnson about what they found.
Well, what we have is six staff members got sick in the 2015 outbreak. Two of them ended up filing complaints with the government for unsafe working conditions. Those complaints got investigated by Rauner's Department of Labor, and the investigation concluded with this letter that we obtained saying Rauner's Department of Veterans Affairs, which manages the veterans' home, did not do enough to notify employees about what was going on. The letter said that Veterans Affairs, quote, failed to effectively notify all employees of the outbreak or instructed them as to proper precautions to avoid or eliminate exposure in a timely manner. And the way that they notified employees was in part by mass emails, which was found to be inadequate.
And Dave, in your reporting as well, you found there were issues with one of the emails too.
Well, yeah, the mass email appeared to downplay the Legionnaires' threat, you know, pretty persuasively. It even specified that the staff shouldn't tell residents about it for fear of, quote, upsetting them. It was sent on August 22nd of 2015, and it said that there was, quote, an unconfirmed diagnosis of Legionnaires at the home. And that's totally inaccurate because at the time it was sent, there were at least two confirmed cases that we know about through documents that we've obtained. So really, you have two things happening here. First, the employees, like the nurses who take care of these residents, they weren't getting the same information that officials had at the beginning of the 2015 outbreak. And then you also have the Labor Department's finding that not all of the employees there even have access to email. So some of them might not have even seen the email in the first place.
So, Tony, what have employees said about what they knew about the Legionnaires outbreak and when they knew it?
We have Nettie Smith. She's an employee at the veterans home, and she is a union official there. Nettie Smith gave testimony to a panel of lawmakers earlier this year about how she found out about the outbreak by seeing a news report on Facebook, not from administrators at the home.
Because information wasn't shared quickly and efficiently, one of my coworkers got sicker than she should have from Legionnaires' disease.
And Dave, how does that compare with what Rauner's administration has been telling lawmakers at these hearings?
Well, I mean, the director of Veteran Affairs, Erica Jeffries, she's quitting her job next week. She testified to legislators earlier this year that besides the emails, there were staff town halls and informational materials posted at nursing stations. And she did something really pretty aggressive. She took a transcript of the testimony that Nettie Smith and others in the union gave to legislators, and she wrote out a point-by-point counter-argument to much of what they said. And she was trying to make the case to legislators that it was the union who was being misleading.
So, Tony, that means on the one hand, we have the Rauner Veterans Affairs Department saying they did everything right. And on the other hand, we have Rauner's Labor Department saying they didn't. So how do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, well, we asked about that. Veterans Affairs, they're just standing by everything that they've already said. And a spokesman for the Labor Department said that their conclusion was Veterans Affairs did not violate a specific law or standard, but they did have concerns about workplace safety. That means, really, that Veterans Affairs faced no consequences from the Labor Department.
IPR's Greta Johnson talked with reporters Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold about the latest in the Legionnaires' disease outbreak in Quincy. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. All of us at GLT have two important words we want you to hear. Thank you. Oh!
Nearly 500 people contributed during the latest fund drive.
I'm GLT financial supporter Alexis Holstein.
I'm Dan Lannon.
I'm Carolyn Pitts.
We're grateful so many of you value NPR and GLT and everything we do, but guess what?
The fund drive may be over, but it's not too late for you to contribute.
We fell a little short, so we hope you'll take the time to contribute.
Pledge at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the University of Illinois system. With research, healthcare training, and academic programs, the U of I system's goal is to enrich lives throughout Illinois. Three universities, Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, and Springfield, one system, altogether extraordinary. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. The Trump administration and the maturing of social media has forced the Capitol steps to be more flexible when writing their political comedy when traveling from city to city. That's according to founding member Elena Newport. Speaking with GLT's John Norton via Skype ahead of the Capitol steps appearance at the BCPA on Sunday, Newport says the founding of the comedy troupe has an Illinois connection.
The Capitol steps started as a Senate office Christmas party. We were working for Senator Charles Percy from Illinois, and he was one of those Republican moderates that you only read about now in history books. You never find them in the wild anymore.
Yeah, no kidding.
So we were truly just, okay, what are we going to do at this year's Christmas party? We worked up a few songs. It was the early days of Reagan. It was kind of a fun time. And we thought somebody would tell us to stop or fire us or both, because here we were making fun of the people that employed us. But Percy was very nice. He invited us to perform at many events at his house. He was a good sport, and he didn't tell us to stop. So here we are.
So how much flack have you gotten over the years? I mean, have you gotten any for doing what you're doing and knowing the people that you're making fun of?
Well, you know, we fully expected that. We fully expected that we would get lots of complaints, you know, stop doing this here, respect your employers, all that. And that was one of the big surprises over the years, is that a lot of the presidents that were in office while we were around invited us to perform. Reagan, Clinton, both, we've performed for both Bushes. And the only senator who ever got really mad was Alphonse D'Amato from New York. And he came up to me after a show one time, and he was mad because we didn't have a song about him.
Really? Oh.
Yeah,
oh.
That was it. That was like the worst thing you could do to certain politicians is ignore him or her. They just, you know.
So do you have some of those politicians or their staffers come up and say, you know, here's an idea for, you know, Senator X, or right?
No, we actually, George Bush Sr. Was probably the one who was friendliest to us. And he actually got up on stage with us once or twice and sang. I use the term loosely. But it was great sport. And after we performed for Reagan, he came up on stage and he said, "No, thank you very much. Now you're all under arrest." So, you know, he had that great timing, the comedic timing, and it was a fun event.
So are you guys all former staffers or current staffers, a little bit of both?
We have all left our day jobs against all advice. They started to notice we weren't showing up a lot of days. Like, I worked on the Hill for 7 years while I also did the Capitol steps, and there we would start to travel and people would notice, hey, where's Elena today? And I got away with that for a while, but then, you know, unless you're the actual politician, you can't do that for long.
Well, everything has changed in the last couple of years, hasn't it? And I mean, I'll give you one word and you go with it, right? Trump.
Well, yeah, it is. The news cycle is so fast. You know, in some ways, Trump is good for business. In other ways, it's just exhausting because you try to stay ahead of this guy. It's almost impossible. I remember during the campaign, I was thinking, well, this guy's pretty funny. And I think I'll write a joke where he goes out and he says, I never kiss babies on the campaign trail. Babies are losers. Get a job, babies. You know. And I thought, okay, that's an exaggeration of something he might say. But then a couple weeks later, he actually got into a fight with a baby at a campaign rally and kicked the baby out because the baby was crying. So yeah. Then I'm like, well, I give up.
I remember that. Yeah. So you have to adapt pretty quickly to what's going on in today's news cycle. Are you able to keep up with that? Do you try to keep up with that? Or where do you draw the line on that?
Well, you know, sometimes you really are wondering whether a story will hang in the news long enough to be funny 6 months later or even a day later. So I have been known to occasionally text a joke to someone standing backstage waiting to go on. But that's kind of unusual. That's if something really big happened and you have to say something about it. But a lot of these stories, like the Russia scandal and the partisan bickering, have hung in the news for months and months, and will. And you know, Putin's not going anywhere, and he's been in our show for several years. And I did mention the shirtless thing, so I want to do a partial nudity warning here.
Well, this is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. We're talking with Elena Newport, a founding member of Capital Steps, who are at the BCPA here real soon. Now, I know you do more than Donald Trump, but I mean, what are some of the other challenges you face in the Trump era and the social media era?
We try to keep our show bipartisan, so that's been a challenge because the party in power is always a little bit funnier, and we always have lots about whoever's running the White House, and especially if they're running the Senate and the Congress, too. But we make a great effort in our show to have, you know, we'll have Bernie Sanders out there. He's not going away. That's good. We have Elizabeth Warren in the show. We have Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in the show. So we're always looking for ways to make the show bipartisan and kind of, you know, we'll get the guy you like in the first song and the guy you don't like in the second song.
How do you make Bernie Sanders funny?
Well, you get him out there and you have him singing a show tune. You try getting a wig that's bad enough for Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. So we have him singing If There Were No Rich Men. That was one of our Bernie songs, to If I Were a Rich Man.
Okay.
And, I always like to say, if you've ever wanted to see Donald Trump sing a rock song and Bernie Sanders sing a show tune and Vladimir Putin dance shirtless, this is the show for you because you will not see that anywhere else.
So as the Capital Steps, a comedy troupe, were you licking your chops when Donald Trump was elected, or were you going, I mean, in some ways it's very helpful, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, unless there's a nuclear war, and then that's probably hard for everybody.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's hard to make fun of nuclear war, although we do have a song right now called How Do You Solve a Problem Like Korea about the talks that are coming up.
Any chance you're taking a stab at this year's White House Correspondents' Dinner that just passed as we're talking?
You know, it's funny you should mention that because we performed it that years ago, before it was like something that anybody even knew about. Back during the Clinton years, and we performed for it a couple times. And I don't remember getting the kind of press that Michelle Wolf is getting. But, our show is a lot of puns, wordplay. A lot of times the songs that we write about somebody could do right in front of that person. So, you know, it's all in good fun.
Well, you mentioned it's a bipartisan staff. I mean, are you including libertarians and socialists in that as well, or is that just Democrats and Republicans?
So, that's true. That's true. We have, in our cast, we have all political stripes, from the most liberal to the most conservative. And we have lively discussions backstage, but we keep the show bipartisan, and everybody goes out and they do what their role or what their script says, unless they forget the words.
So. Elena Newport, founding member of the Capital Steps, is joining us via Skype on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Well, we kind of touched on this, but progressives over the last few years especially have tried to pull the Democratic Party to the left, right? And beginning in about 2009-10, the Tea Party began pulling the Republicans to the right, and they probably pulled the Republican Party farther to the right than progressives have had success pulling to the left. But does the fact that these parties are, you know, so far apart now, does that make it easier to write material?
Well, I don't know if it makes it easier, but I think it makes it more important that we do this because, you know, everybody had that experience after the election of trying to have a conversation at their Thanksgiving dinner table with relatives that felt very differently than they did. And it was very unpleasant and partisan and the fights on Facebook and all that. And we were really kind of concerned about it. And so the best compliment that we got after that election was people coming up to us after the show and saying, you know, I wasn't sure I could laugh, but I did and I feel better.
What's something new in the show that you might want to tip us off to that people might get a kick out of?
Well, let's see. We've got a song that we're just working up about Paul Ryan leaving. Hang Down Your Head, Paul Ryan, about getting out of all of this. We've got Melania singing, telling why she loves Donald in spite of the Stormy Daniels. We've got her singing, I Want a Man with a Small Hand, about why she loves Donald. We've got Stormy in the show, an exclusive Stormy Weather cover. And all the characters that are in the headlines, there's going to be 30 songs and skits in the show. It's not going to be just Trump. It's going to be almost everybody you can think of, Betsy DeVos, Ben Carson, Elizabeth Warren, even fake news people like Wolf Blitzer. So it's going to be people running on and off stage, grabbing wigs, changing accents, doing songs, about 30 songs and skits in an hour and a half.
Capital Steps founding member Elena Newport speaking with GLT's John Norton. The Comedy Troupe's latest show is titled Orange is the New Barack. The Capital Steps appear at the BCPA in downtown Bloomington Sunday. You're listening to The Capital Steps and Trump Acres.
I'm moving up with my luscious Melania.
New York is where I want to be. In Washington they stare at me. My White House portrait can't be lewd.
It's gonna be real classy and also nude.
Oh. Big wheel.
Big deal.
Big plans.
Big hands.
Land of the free.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Thank you for voting for my husband, Barack Trump.